Today's interview is brought to you by Algorand. You'll be hearing more about them as well as Decipher 2022, their event in Dubai, later on in the show. But for now, let's get on with today's interview. I'm joined by Richard Field, Director of the Institute for Financial Transparency. Richard, great to have you on Forward Guidance. How are you doing?
Great. Jack, yourself?
Can't complain. Richard, we were just talking about, well, how about you tell us? How about you tell the audience what we were just talking about?
I was telling you this has been the world's greatest week for me. It started off with Ben Bernanke getting the Nobel Prize for his lack of insights into financial crisis in banking. Clearly, it was the Nobel Committee saying to the world, bailouts of insolvent, very large banks are a great idea. Which, by the way, isn't surprising because the Nobel Prize for Economics is actually sponsored by a Swedish bank. And if we go back in history just a little bit to 1990s, you'll notice that in Sweden, they had a financial crisis. And the way they handled their financial crisis was they said to all of their banks, you guys got all this bad debt on your books, you got to write it off. Now, we're going to look at you after you've written it all off and say, if you're solvent, you've got to go raise capital. If you're not solvent, we're going to close you down, which is what they did. Now, as for the solvent ones, they said you got to get to a capital ratio, let's call it 5%. If they couldn't raise that amount of money from the private market, the Swedish government put in money as preferred stock. But they put it in at an incredibly high rate. So all the returns flowed to the Swedish taxpayers as opposed to the private equity investors who came in.
So this is an example of something that was done well. You look to the Swedish model.
This is exactly how it should be done. However, notice that the Swedish bank would not like that model. This was bad for the bankers. So they loved the Bernanke model, which skips steps 1 and 2. The first step being write down the bad debt. The second step being check to see if they're solvent or not. The Bernanke model, as shown in 2008, was inject the funds immediately, if you recall.
Yeah. Let's walk the clock back a little bit. So Ben Bernanke, he studied economics, got his PhD, and I think he was very interested in the Great Depression and the failures of the central bankers during the Great Depression, which, you know, are quite apparent if you look back at the historical record. You have industrial production falls 30%, and what do? You increase rates. You strengthen the currency instead of decreasing the currency. You remove liquidity. So, you know, he's a student, and he correctly pointed out just the mistakes, and he wanted to learn from it. So going in, you know, when did he take over from Greenspan? 2005, 2006, whenever he did, he was like, I'm, he sensed something was brewing. He said, I'm not going to make the same mistake as, let's say, Benjamin Strong or Montague Norman. But you say he did make mistakes. What were his mistakes?
I start off when I start looking at something like the Great Depression, and I go, who actually knows something about the Great Depression? So I looked for those types of people. And the first person I found who actually was living when I first looked at the Great Depression was a woman by the name of Anna Schwartz. She's an economist, and I don't know if your viewers are familiar with her, but she wrote a book and her co-author was a gentleman by the name of Milton Friedman. And this book was the Bible. Okay? It describes all the bad things the central banks did during the Great Depression, and how they made it worse. And it says, that's not how you should run monetary policy. Okay? Fast forward to October 2008, and there is this fabulous interview. They're interviewing Anna Schwartz, and she is saying, Ben Bernanke didn't learn a single lesson from the Great Depression and what you're supposed to do. He's doing it all wrong.
All right. Tell me about that, Richard, because Bernanke did not follow the Bank of England model of the 1931 model that really wrecked things. I mean, he did inject tons of liquidity, and that is precisely what central bankers during the Great Depression did not do, that exacerbated it. And it's a lot more complicated than that. They were on the gold standard. But in what way did Bernanke not learn from the central bankers of the Great Depression.
If you look back to the Great Depression in the U.S., you'll notice that when FDR came in and became president, in the first week after his he was sworn in, we had a national bank holiday. And the interesting thing about that national bank holiday, because at the time there were lots of runs on banks, was the end of the holiday corresponded with a fireside chat. And in the fireside chat, what he said is, we aren't going to reopen a bank that isn't solvent. I.e., they went in to various banks and they said, we're looking at your books, and they use bankers to do this. And they said, after you take your losses, are you solvent or not? Are your assets worth more than your book value of your liabilities? If the answer was yes, then they reopened them. The answer was no, they didn't. By doing that, they forced banks to take losses. The key when you have a financial crisis is that it's always triggered by the fact you have excess debt in the system and everybody knows there are losses. They just don't know where the losses are. So your bank's got to recognize the losses, otherwise nobody trusts the bank. Okay? So that's the first thing that they were supposed to do. Bernanke didn't do that. Why didn't he do that? Well, I think it's Paulson and Geithner's influence there, by the way. Paulson would not have wanted Goldman Sachs to have to write down all of its losses. Okay? Goldman would have been out of business. What came out of 33 with the bank holiday is they wrote down all the bad debt. And the economy actually started up again. While they wrote down all the debt, they opened up the solvent institute, the quote, solvent ones. They put in preferred stock to get everybody up to a certain level. They also introduced deposit insurance, which effectively ended bank runs from individuals because your deposits were now guaranteed by the U.S. government, so you didn't care how the bank was actually performing.
So, Richard, in what way did Goldman not write down its losses in 2008? It's my understanding that, like all of the other investment banks, Goldman had huge losses that were not marked up, but they had a giant hedge with that they had via credit default swaps, so they actually did quite well. It's just that the people who they bought insurance from, the credit default swap CDS, happened to be AIG, and they were going to go insolvent, right? So if you include the CDS, I think Goldman was doing okay.
Well,
that's my perception. I could be wrong.
Okay. You're only doing okay if the counterparty is solvent. If the counterparty isn't solvent, then you're not doing okay. So if the U.S. government doesn't step up to bail out AIG, Goldman isn't solvent. And it's Goldman who should, and their shareholders who should have taken the loss. So they should have done their homework to say, ooh, AIG isn't solvent.
So you think that the government should not have bailed out AIG?
No chance.
Okay.
You let AIG go through bankruptcy, and whatever the bankruptcy estate says is what the bankruptcy estate says. And by the way, this is the point that Anna Schwartz was making in her interview. She said, you got to address the losses that are in the financial system. You can't sweep them under the rug. And that's what Bernanke was doing. Okay, when you think of ZIRP, when you think of QE, all of this was designed to put the losses under the rug and pray that something happened to take care of those losses. If you look, my favorite chart comes from BIS. They track debt zombies, a concept that didn't exist in 2008 outside of Japan. A debt zombie is a firm where for the last 3 years, it hasn't made enough money to cover its debt payments. In the U.S. in 2008, less than 3% of corporate America would have qualified as a debt zombie. According to the BIS, we are now close to 20%. It grows exponentially. And why? Because the debt zombie isn't pricing for profit for shareholders. It's just pricing to get enough cash flow to try to cover some of its debt payments.
Yes, I share your criticism of this whole, like, let's raise $1 billion to have a company, a juice company, and we're going to sell products for $700, and we're going to get all these engineers, and we're not a product company, we're a platform company. I think that's all totally BS. I'm with you there, Rich. You're saying that Bernanke should not have cut rates to zero, should not have done QE maybe, but you're also saying this banking thing. I feel like there are a lot of different things. Can we stick on the banking losses thing?
Yeah, let's stay on the banking losses. Okay, banks make loans. That's the business that they're in. Banks are supposed to evaluate the companies to which they make the loan. Okay? So you got to think of a bank as nothing more than a sophisticated investor. Now, we always say that all investors are responsible for all the gains and losses on their investments. In 2008, Bernanke comes in and says, banks, you're no longer responsible for your losses. I.e., we socialize the losses, we let you privatize the gains. What happens at this point is we got a bunch of companies and a bunch of borrowers who are way underwater, okay? But the Fed's not forcing them, the banks, to recognize those companies as being underwater and cutting their debts, okay? That didn't happen. We didn't have the get rid of the debt that's loser debt. In 2008. Instead, he had a whole series of programs designed to keep the banks afloat and hide the bad debt.
There's TARP, Toxic Asset Relief Program, where they actually, the toxic shit, if I can use that phrase, and I think I can because it's my podcast, that was the actually insolvent stuff that was taken onto, I believe, the Treasury's balance sheet. The Federal Reserve, when they bought, you know, trillions of dollars worth of securities, it was agency mortgage-backed securities, which, you know, are guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie, right? So it's not as if the Fed bought, you know, the mortgage that was in The Big Short or something like that. Like that was maybe bought by the Treasury or the CDO or something. But that's a distinction to draw, right?
There's yes and a no to that, because the Treasury did not go through and take off of every bank all of their subprime exposures. Because they couldn't value the subprime exposures. TARP was originally supposed to be, we'll buy all these junk subprime securities. Well, then the question became, how do you value them? And of course, people immediately said, well, you can't value them at 50 cents on the dollar if they're only worth 20 cents on the dollar, because then you're giving the banks all sorts of money they don't deserve. So that stopped the TARP purchase of those securities. Because TARP was Treasury had no more idea how to value those opaque securities than anybody else. Having said that, what they did with TARP money is they made that the source for putting in money as preferred stock into the banks. And they said to the banks, you all have to come here and we'll give you a bunch of preferred stock. And then they made up a story about how the bankers were so adverse to getting preferred stock.
Richard, I know what you mean, but I just want to make this clear for that. When you say the bank take preferred stock, the bank is not taking preferred stock in the government. The government is taking preferred stock in the bank. And the reason Diamond didn't want to do that was because his bank was the cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry factory. And yeah, like he was like, why do I have to do the same thing? I don't need a bailout, so don't give me a bailout. But the argument Paulson said was, well, if you don't take the bailout, then everyone will know that it's because the other ones, the weak ones, are weak, and then that will cause a crisis of confidence. Yeah.
Right. Now, let's go back to 1933 a second. They had a really brilliant thought in 1933. The brilliant thought that they had was, why should we establish a financial system where the financial stability of our country is dependent on our existing banks, as opposed to making our existing banks dependent on our country? In short, if you look at our financial system, we could get rid of all of our existing banks, reopen new banks tomorrow, and our real economy wouldn't miss a beat. The existing banks need the country, but the country doesn't need them. So Jamie Dimon's company would have gone away overnight. We should have done away with all the too-big-to-fail banks. It may have taken a couple of years to wind them all down, but the point is that's what should have occurred. occurred in 2008. What the Nobel Prize Committee was rewarding Ben with the Nobel Prize for was preventing that from happening.
What about the systemic bank failure, though, that insolvent companies, insolvent banks, when they go bankrupt, if you have if I have $250,000, that is guaranteed by the FDIC, but what if I have more than, if you have $260,000, the first $250,000 is there, but the next $10,000, it's a bad loan and you're probably not going to get it back. If you lent it to, Citigroup, for example. So let's say a bank wants to do $1 billion transaction. I mean, are they going to have to, do 4,000 different transactions to send $1 billion if they only do $250,000 as FDIC insurance?
When you say a bank wants to do $1 billion transaction, we got to kind of come at this from a couple of different perspectives here. The first one is, in the mid-1980s, we had an industry called the savings and loan industry. It was known to be bankrupt in the mid-1980s because the Fed had raised rates, and these guys had a portfolio that consisted of 30-year mortgages, that was their assets, and a floating rate deposit base. So they were hemorrhaging cash. The fact is, even though they were insolvent, everybody knew they could stay afloat and continue in operation, making loans until such time as the federal government was organized to resolve them, i.e. take them on a Friday, close them down, and reopen, having moved their assets that were the good assets into a new entity, and take the old assets and put them into a bad entity.
But why would you keep your money in the bank if you know it's insolvent? Wouldn't there be a crisis of confidence?
No.
Why not?
Because there's no reason for the government to take somebody who's a depositor and make them absorb losses. They understand who's a depositor / an investor versus who bought equity in a bank, who bought, subordinate debt in a bank that's unsecured. All those people are the ones who are supposed to get hit with losses. Depositors.
Right, so the first quarter of $1 million is protected by the FDIC.
The first quarter of a million is protected by the FDIC, but I'm saying, let's take a company that has 100 employees, okay? That company will typically have more than $1 million at a bank at any instant in time solely to cover payroll.
Yes.
Okay? As the government, they're smart enough to know that. So they're smart enough not to go after that guy's deposits.
But how does that guy know that? I mean,
how do they know that? Because the government only has to say it. They get to say, you keep your deposits, we're not going after the deposits, the guys are going to lose their money, and they can list off.
But where is that said? What law is that said?
When you say what law?
How do people know that the government has their back over $250,000? Is that official policy that, if a bank goes under?
The FDIC can freely say it. Effectively, it can and it would. If that's what they intended to do was to close down those banks, they would say, if you've got deposits in these banks, you don't have to worry. We've got your back on those deposits. So effectively, we've given you an unlimited deposit guarantee.
But the guarantees only up to $250,000, right? I mean, are there instances of the FDIC bailing people out above that?
Continental Illinois.
Okay. Tell me about
Continental Illinois, they moved all the deposits and they wiped out everybody who I just described in those groups. The equity holders got wiped out. The subordinated debt holders got wiped out, the preferred stockholders. So there's a history of doing
so
exactly.
So people who had above $250,000 of
back
deposit.
Then it was $100,000.
People who had above $100,000, their deposits were guaranteed as well.
They got
protected. So why have it be $100,000 or $250,000 at all? Why not just say FDIC insures everything?
Because the FDIC asserts fees to the banking industry based on how much is covered. If you said every deposit is covered, the banking industry would have to pay a whole lot more in fees to the FDIC.
Okay.
It's as simple as that.
So you're saying that it's impossible to, even though if you read the law says, Jack, if you have $260,000 in the bank, the first $250,000 is good. That's insured. But the next $10,000 is your risk. You're saying that that's effectively, it's true in the law, but in the spirit of the law, in actuality, that's not true. That everything, you know, if let's say you had $1 billion at a bank as a bank depositor, the FDIC has your back no matter what.
Yeah, but essentially.
You have to be pretty confident in that. I mean,
you should be very confident because the FDIC, think about what its goal is, Jack. Its goal is to protect the depositors and the real economy. It knows it's going to temporarily borrow money, if it's a big enough problem, from taxpayers so as to make depositors whole. That is the crux of the issue here. You know, we talked about how, there was this whole thing about how we had to nationalize banks. They didn't have to nationalize banks. They weren't going to close a bank until they were ready to resolve it. Okay? So you got to put the losses on the people who are the investors who are supposed to take losses. As I said, they're very good at distinguishing between an investor and, as I said, the firm that has the $1 million. When you say somebody has $1 billion of deposits just sitting there, well, that's an individual with $1 billion. Is that an investor? They might want to slice it that way, okay, and say, well, you're an investor as opposed to like a bank, you know, as the 100-person firm we discussed earlier.
What about Apple? Okay. Apple has $1 billion bank deposit. I mean,
I think that they would protect an Apple. And it's just so simple.
Okay,
for
but Richard, I think you're the most confident person I've ever met in this theory that the FDIC has your back. And you said you think. Like, I feel like people have to be 100% sure that their money is safe. And people who know the law, know it's $250,000, but to not pull your money, you have to be 99.99999% sure. And I mean, it doesn't even seem like you're 99% sure.
I'm 99%. As I said, what you're wrestling with is would Sheila Bair have said to depositors, your depositors are good?
Can you tell the audience who Sheila Bair is? She's the chairwoman of the FDIC, right?
Yeah, she was a chairwoman of the FDIC. And she wanted to actually close some of these too-big-to-fail banks. And Paulson, Bernanke, and Geithner wouldn't let her. And
She closed some of them, right? She did close a few.
I think she closed WAMU, but WAMU, not really. It got sold. I think every one of them got sold. I'm not actually sure that we actually closed one as opposed to that they got sold. Wachovia got sold. Washington Mutual got sold. I'm not convinced that there were any that were really of the big guys who actually got closed. Maybe IndyMac, but even them, I think, got sold.
Okay, but so, Richard, let's say I have a deposit with Washington Mutual, WAMU. Instead of a shotgun marriage being arranged between WAMU and whoever bought WAMU, I forget. Instead, Sheila Bair shuts down WAMU. I have money at WAMU. Let's say I have, $500,000 at WAMU. I would love that. But let's say it shut down. How do I get my money out?
Remember how we shut down and how that shutdown works. The resolution. The day they shut it down is a Friday after the close of business. So you can't get your money anyhow until Monday. On Monday, we have a new entity set up that replaces it. In this case, it's a new entity. Now, let's go back to why I'm 99.99% sure. Let's look at Iceland, because Iceland's a really interesting example. Iceland literally had to replace its entire banking system. But they didn't wipe out the depositors. And one of the things that happens when the country takes over its banking system, it gets the opportunity and has the preferred stock. It gets the opportunity to sell its interest in the banks. And it turns out that a clean bank with no credit problems at all is very valuable. There are lots of people who are willing to pay for that interest. So it turns out, like in Iceland's case, they got out without losing any money. Again, guaranteeing far above what people would have thought going in. Same
you can say the same thing about TARP, right? The Treasury made money on the...
TARP is a strange and peculiar instrument because, as I said, they didn't do the take the losses up front. They didn't take check for solvency. All they did was they gave them $25 billion. And then people said,
so TARP bought the collateral, the CDOs, the synthetic CDOs, the subprime mortgage-backed securities, whatever. They bought that at levels that I think you said are exceeded values, because if they recognized the values, they would buy it much less. But I'm pretty sure, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, that even at those rich valuations that are, you know, they gave them a sweetheart deal, I still think the Treasury made money. So any institution, it's very hard for a mega institution that has $1 trillion or plus to lose money, no matter what type of crap that you buy. So I'm just saying that, like, the Icelandic government made money buying banks, but so did the Treasury, buying like the worst collateral ever at overvalued levels.
But let's come back to what you said earlier. How can you be confident that your money's going to be good as the depositor? You just said, look, a $1 trillion institution probably has enough asset value lying around someplace that when all is said and done, and we get rid of all the bad crap on there, chances are they got enough to cover the deposits. But they don't have to have enough to cover the deposits. They just have to have enough so that when the government puts in money, the government feels comfortable it will get its money back out.
How does the FDIC get its funds? Is it funded by the Treasury or...
It's two ways. One, they charge banks for the insurance, so there's an insurance premium. And the second one is they have a line of credit with the Treasury. Now imagine, rather than going to Congress and saying we want $750 billion in some blind pool that we can use however we want, they had gone to Congress and said, we think the Treasury, that the FDIC needs $750 billion. You know, increase in its line of credit so that it can handle all of these bad banks and winding them down. Think of how much easier that would have been to get through Congress. Because everybody knows that FDIC is out there to protect deposits. FDIC is saying, we got your deposits covered, gang. You don't have to worry. We're just going to clean out all these bad assets. And oh, by the way, those banks are going to get broken up. The bankers are going to get punished. That's the story of, that should have been the story of 2008. Instead, we ended up with ZERP. We ended up with QE. We ended up creating zombie companies. We could not have had a worse policy response.
We interrupt this program with breaking news. Algorand is hosting an event in Dubai from November 28th through November 30th, and I am going to be there. Decipher 2022 is a gathering of investors, developers, and founders featuring deep dives on blockchain's most important topics, interoperability, DeFi, sports, gaming, and the metaverse. It's an unparalleled learning opportunity. You need to be there. Think about it. You're going to be coming from Thanksgiving. Your family members are going to be wondering why you won't stop talking about the Federal Reserve. This is exactly what you need to stay in the most beautiful city in the world and meet and learn from leaders in the blockchain industry. By the way, if you are there, I will talk macro with you. So get a ticket today and come hang out with me in Dubai. Tickets are available now at decipherevent.com. And for a limited time, you can use code DecipherFam22 for a discount on your pass. That's decipherevent.com. There is a live stream, so if you can't be there in Dubai, you can watch it remotely. However, there are certain things you'll only get to know if you're there in person, such as, will I remember to bring sunblock? If you ask me about how the reverse repo facility actually works, will I pretend to know the answer, or will I be honest and say I have no clue? Decipher is hosted by Algorand, the world's most secure, scalable, and sustainable blockchain. Founded by Silvio Micali, the co-inventor of Zero Knowledge Proofs, Algorand recently partnered with FIFA to launch FIFA Plus Collect, the league's official NFT marketplace. With the World Cup going on in Qatar at this time, there are sure to be a ton of eyes and attention on that. So clearly there is a lot going on, not just for the Algorand ecosystem, but in the region more generally. So go to decipherevent.com. It's going to be a great event, and I hope to see you there. Now, let's get back to the interview. Richard, I just want to draw a distinction between, I think so far your criticism is of TARP and of not shutting down banks that you say are insolvent, and I mean the line between liquidity, illiquidity, and insolvency, it's pretty close. So, especially in times of turmoil,
illiquidity always crushes a bank.
Yeah.
You can be a solvent bank, but if you there's the perception that you do not have liquidity, you go out of business.
Right, but I'm saying like Lehman Brothers. To the extent that it was insolvent, it's because its liabilities exceeded its assets. But the reason that its assets were so low was because of a liquidity problem. Like, if there was more liquidity, I don't think the CDOs would be worth 20 cents on the dollar. They might have been, I'm saying the line is thin. That's all I'm saying. But Richard, what I was saying before is that, so I think that is a very well articulated critique of TARP, the Treasury buying all this crap in 2008, as well as not having Sheila Bair knock on the doors of insolvent banks and shut them down. But I think that's different than zero rates and QE. I mean, are you assuming that like your FDIC insurance would have been so good, this plan was so effective that you wouldn't have to do QE and you wouldn't have to have low rates?
There's no need for either one of those. You did not need QE. You did not need ZIRP if you go in and take care of the bad debts. That was not a requirement for getting your economy going again.
So where do the losses...
So who takes the losses? Well, you're absolutely right. You know who's going to take the losses. You're going to look at a city. And they're likely to have hundreds of millions, if not several billion dollars worth of losses. So city ends up being broken up. Okay? All those losses flow through the old city.
But by the very nature of the word insolvent, liabilities exceed the assets. So there's nothing to absorb the losses because it's already dead. You know what I mean? City's already dead. What can absorb it? Like a bankrupt.
Imagine that you bankrupt a second. This one I think will work for us.
Yeah.
We start off with a bank that has $100 of assets, $95 of deposits, and $5 worth of equity.
Mm-hmm.
Book equity. Mm-hmm. Okay. The $100 worth of assets turns out to be worth, $75. Okay. The deposits are still worth $80 when we write it down. But now what's the book value of the equity worth? Minus $20, right?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. FDIC steps in. FDIC says, look at that. Losses have been taken. They all went through the accounting of the company that's in bank that's insolvent. We take the 75 of assets over to a new company. We take the 80 of deposits over to a new bank. So now they're both sitting in a new bank. We, the FDIC, put in $5 million to get it back to being balanced again. So there's $5 million cash goes in. $5 million of equity is now on the balance sheet or whatever we need to do. At that point, we, the FDIC, can now sell equity in that bank. Okay, so we get our money out, the FDIC, leaving the new shareholders in place. And they have a clean bank that has equity in it, and the assets and liabilities match up, if that makes sense.
Yes. In this case, though, it has no bondholders. So in this case, it would have to be the depositors to take the loss. But I see what you're saying.
Depositors didn't take any loss here. What took the loss just flows through the accounting statement. Okay?
But I'm saying the equity holders have no more to lose. They've already lost their $5 billion. They can't...
Right, and they're gone.
Yeah. So who takes the other 20? Sorry, the FDIC?
No, nobody takes the extra 20. It goes through an accounting statement of an entity that's out of business. The 20 just gets written down.
But you have $95 billion worth of deposits. I just added a billion to it. $95 billion worth of deposits, $75 billion worth of assets. Where does that 20 come from?
The FDIC puts it in initially to get the deposits and the assets to back to what it needs to be. And then it gets out by selling out its position.
Its position in the bank? In the new bank?
In the new bank.
Okay. So you're saying that the FDIC plugs the hole, but the way that it plugs the hole without spending a gazillion dollars is by having the new bank be valuable and selling those assets. But I guess in the case of Iceland, how is it valuable. How did you just sort of create $20 billion out of thin air, you know?
Well, you didn't. The way you created $20 billion out of thin air is now you have good assets of 75. They got what they pay on their deposits, and you can look at the net interest margin, and you can say, oh, look at all that income that's pouring to the bottom line. That's a good bank. That's valuable, all that income.
Okay, Richard, so like, if we did this in the U.S., would there be good net interest margins if you shut down all of the insolvent banks? Because net interest margins is the spread between what you pay depositors pay, what you have to pay for deposits, and then what you earn on loans. But, I mean, it sounds like the loans are bad,
right? Yeah, it clearly would have worked. Yeah, it clearly would have worked. There was no doubt about it at the time. What you would have done, though, is you would have gotten rid of a lot of Wall Street. Citi would have gone away. You'd have had Citi broken up into, say, 50 little banks.
Right.
Okay? Because now, once the FDIC has it for resolution, there's no reason it has to recreate a big Citi. It can recreate small cities. Okay? Same thing for the JP Morgans.
But what are... Those businesses that Citi does that have, quote, good assets. Okay, yes, you're saying get rid of the Wall Street people, get rid of the CDO machine, get rid of the subprime origination. But I think the, quote, safe and good businesses, let's call them consumer lending, credit cards, corporate lending, whatever. I think you're assuming that that would not get affected by shutting down banks. Whereas, I don't know, maybe Ben Bernanke's assumption, and maybe I don't know, I'm convicted by the Bernanke case, is that... You cause a lot of collateral damage. I mean, you know, banks just released their earnings today. I mean, five of them. Oh, and by the way, so you think JP Morgan, you think a lot of banks are insolvent now, which I want to get into in a second. But banks released their earnings today, and, you know, they had the net interest margins. The spreads have gone up because deposit rates have not gone up, even though interest rates have gone up, and they're earning more, so it's good. But, like, I just feel maybe I'm wrong. I mean, but, like, I just think that if you shut down banks... how can the lending business work if you shut down a bank? You know?
Let's go back to the lessons from the savings and loans first. Because the savings and loans were insolvent didn't mean they stopped lending. Okay? That's one of these narrative assumptions that Bernanke et al. Throw out there.
But wouldn't they be in total violation? They're not allowed to create credit anymore because they're in violation of equity rules. Like
the only reason they wouldn't be able to... The only reason they would not be able to make a loan is that the government says you cannot make a loan. So long as the government says you are in business and allows you to be in business, you can continue to make loans. Okay? The moment they say you're not in business, which is that Friday evening, you're not making a loan anyhow between then and the Monday morning.
I get what you're saying as a framework, a hypothetical framework. And yeah, sure, they did it in Iceland. But I mean, it's the fact now that like JP Morgan has to think about its equity ratio of how much equity it has. And if it's in violation of that, it gets penalized. You know, suddenly you have people knocking on Jamie Dimon's door. But I mean, like in your case, the equity is zero because there's no equity at all. I mean, that's...
Well, let's go back. What we know is they have no equity. Okay. Savings and loans, it was known they had no equity in the mid-80s, okay? Even though it was known they had no equity, they continued to lend. This is what banks do. They engage
in
lending.
When you say it was known, does that suggest that it was sort of, it was not official, but everyone knew it was insolvent? Because if it's everyone knows it, but it's not officially recognized, that's not recognizing the losses. Like, was there actually a bank balance sheet where it said...
They didn't recognize the losses until after they closed them all down.
Okay.
It was known because the regulator came out and came up with a wonderful thing to plug the hole in their balance sheet. So that even though the balance sheet was headed into massively negative numbers, the regulator was literally, quote, giving them capital through an accounting machination. So all I'm saying here is the borrowers, the borrowers from these SNLs knew the SNL was bankrupt. But that didn't stop them. The SNLs gave them loans at favorable rates. It didn't stop the SNL from being able to get funding. The SNL turned to a bunch of places who were happy to deposit money in them because the SNLs were willing to pay a premium for funds. Okay? It's mythical that banks will stop lending. They're in the business to make good loans. They're going to continue until the moment you close them down. That's what lending officers do, is make loans.
Morale would be a little low? It's like, hey, talk to some person next to you. Hey, we did such a bad job making loans that we don't exist anymore as a company. But on Monday, we're going to be a new corporate entity. I don't know. I feel like my morale as a loan officer would be a little bit impaired, you know?
My morale as a loan officer is where did we lose all of our money? Did we lose the money from the loans that I was making? Or did we lose the money because our corporate asset liability people, our treasury department, decided to invest in a bunch of subprime securities that they had no idea how to value? Okay? The guy who's lending money to Ford knew what he was lending money to. Okay? His morale isn't hurt beyond the fact that he saw his net worth get destroyed by the other parts of the bank. Okay? And by the way, where are lending officers going to go to? They're going to go to banks. That's what they do. That's what they're trained to do.
Yeah.
And you're kind of asking, like, they're going to go away. They're not. What you saw with QE was Bernanke coming out and saying, part of the reason I'm doing QE is so the banks will lend the money on. That was his explanation for it in 2008, 2009. Remarkably, it turned out that they didn't, quote, lend the money on. And there was actually a knowable reason for that. And the reason is that banks are secured lenders. Everybody in the banking industry was looking at the same basic portfolio of loans, asking themselves, what's a house worth? What's a building, commercial building worth? Okay, the things we're taking security interests, what are they worth? Given all the bad debt that we have linked to these assets, so there could be at any moment in time a huge write down, what are these things worth? So suddenly what they're willing to do is only give up, 40, 50 cents on the dollars for collateral value. Okay, that's what stopped lending. As opposed to, oh my God, we don't have enough lenders. Bernanke, as I said, he went with a whole long narrative. Do you remember his book, The Courage to Act?
I didn't read it, but yeah, I know it, yeah.
Did you ever see the movie A Few Good Men?
No.
Oh, you have got to YouTube the Jack Nicholson doing his Colonel Jessup speech, where he is on the witness stand and he's going, you need people like me up on the wall. Okay? And you have Tom Cruise going, like, no, we don't. We absolutely don't. He was doing his Colonel Jessup. The more you hear it, the more you realize he's wrong. What he was doing just absolutely was the wrong possible solution. Go back to October 2008. There is the Great Depression expert, Anna Schwartz, recognized by everybody in the industry as the expert, going, your approach is wrong. You need to deal with all this bad debt first. Fast forward, here's the Nobel Prize Committee giving an award for the wrong approach. And if you look, we got problems today. We got inflation that is being driven by the supply side, by energy. The Fed is busy raising rates. With the statement by Powell, we're going to raise rates until something breaks. I don't know. I was just reading.
He didn't say that. He didn't say that exactly. He said something to that effect, but he didn't use those words. But yeah.
He's not come out and said, no. We're going to be sure nothing breaks. Okay? Enough people have said that he has said this, that you would think he would come out and go, okay, I'm very aware that there are problems in the financial system, both in the U.S. and globally, and I am not going to let something break in this global system because of how I'm raising rates. Okay? He hasn't said that. We're on a mission to raise rates.
And you think that's a mistake or a good thing or more complicated?
I think it's a unbelievable mistake.
So okay? You thought it was a mistake for Bernanke to cut rates?
It was a mistake for Bernanke to cut rates. It's a mistake for Powell at the current time to be raising rates the way he is. I had no problem, by the way. I've argued for over a decade that rates should never have gone below 2%.
Uh-huh.
2%, by the way, Jack, is a number that I'm not pulling out of thin air. But in the 1870s, Walter Bagehot, who's the father of modern central banking, set as the minimum nominal rate. And he said, if it goes below that, you'll end up with all sorts of economic headwinds. In the 1930s, John Keynes came along, and he quoted Bagehot on 2% being the minimum nominal rate and agreeing with him.
But what about inflation? I'm going to take a guess that when Walter Bagehot said that, inflation was pretty much zero or maybe 1% or maybe negative 1%, right?
Let's go to inflation because I was at the Fed in the early 1980s.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So this is the moment that the Fed, Volcker's at the top of his game. This is the, Powell wants to channel his inner Volcker, right? Coming out of the 70s, we had energy shocks that were driving inflation. The other item we had driving inflation was we had this idea of excess demand, where the government was still spending a lot of money. We spent a lot of money on Vietnam. Okay, so we created a lot of artificial demand in terms of government spending. The other thing we had going on in the 70s that does not exist today was the unions were very strong. And we had something called a cost of living adjustment. Are you familiar with those?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. 20% of the manufacturing sector got cost of living adjustments because they were unionized.
So if CPI was 16%, they'd get a 16% raise automatically, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. If you went to the retail sector knew that these people had cost of living adjustments over in the manufacturing sector, they automatically gave those same cost of living adjustments to their employees because they knew otherwise their employees would go to the manufacturers to go work for the union, okay? So in order to keep your employees, you were also doing this. Hence, we had this wage price spiral going on. If you're with me?
I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think that logic is precisely why the Fed did not hike in 2021, because it's like, oh, we're in a disinflation era. It's just a little blip.
I'm going to get to that narrative for 2021, okay?
Yeah.
For a second, let me finish with Volcker.
Yeah, sorry.
Important to have the right lessons from 1980. So I'm there. We hike rates incredibly high. We got rates up into the 20%. You know, when the prime rate loans, the so-called best customer, goes for 21%, what do you think that the loan sharks were charging at the same time, okay? It must have been unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But the point was, it didn't slow inflation. While at the Fed, we tried to show that monetary policy actually reduced inflation, that there was a cause and effect between the two. We couldn't do it. So we trotted out the narrative that said it works with long and variable lags. Now, the inside thing was OPEC had more control over inflation than we did. OPEC effectively fell apart in 1981. We had more oil discovered. There was internal fights there. But oil prices came tumbling down. So that was the energy price side of it. The union side of it was we had lots of layoffs because when you get rates up that high, you really do get the economy to crush, you know, slow down. Along comes Ronald Reagan, and he goes after the Air Traffic Controllers Union. And he effectively breaks that union. And when he breaks that union, it's open season for U.S. manufacturers against their unions. And that's the end of cost of living adjustments. Okay, They suddenly start coming out of the contracts, and that's the end of the wage price spiral. Nothing to do with Fed interest rate policy, really. Okay, now fast forward to 2021. We have something called the COVID pandemic. The COVID pandemic results in a global shutdown of our supply chains. Everybody knew when the supply chains reopened, when the world reopened, the supply chains would have to restart. Okay? Not surprisingly, by the way, when it reopened, we had demand for goods that was different than what the supply chains could produce. Okay? For example, when you had everybody at home, people wanted patio furniture so they could sit out and see their friends, okay? People didn't want patio furniture after that opened. They wanted other types of furniture things. So we had a change in the mix. Our supply chains are designed not for big shifts, but for little shifts. Uh-huh. We had something called the bullwhip effect. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. And the bullwhip effect accounts for the inflation. When you have too little supply, because you can't satisfy that demand, obviously manufacturers mark up the price of all their goods. We get inflation. Now those manufacturers, though, have more than satisfied those particular market niches. If you look at like Walmart and Target, they're going into massive sales because they now have more stuff than they know what to do with that they're trying to get rid of in terms of inventory. Okay, so we're now seeing the other side of the bullwhip effect. They overordered because they were double ordering, triple ordering just to get any product in 2 years ago. Now they're on the other side of it where they got all the product and more. So what we're going to see is we're headed into deflation.
When you say deflation, do you mean disinflation or do you mean deflation?
Deflation.
So you don't mean CPI goes from 8% to 2%. You mean it goes from 8% to negative 1% or negative something.
Yeah. We could easily find ourselves, given what the Fed is in the process of doing, I think, looking at negative 5, negative 7.
Okay.
And that could, in the next year, I think we're going to be there, deflation, early 2023.
On a month-over-month basis? Or year-over-year?
Month-over-month.
Month-over-month basis. Okay.
You're going to be sitting there going, look at what just happened. If you look at the housing market has crushed.
Headline and core.
What?
Headline and core.
Headline and core.
Yeah.
All of this stuff. Okay, well, you got to realize there's a certain amount of this trailing crap in the CPI, for example.
Yeah.
That's this owner equivalent rent, which is the ultimate made up number.
Yeah.
And it trails by like 12 months or whatever. Okay, but if you look out, what you're going to be seeing early next year.
But Richard, the Fed does not look at, the CPI, but we shave off the owner's equivalent rent because we all know it's BS. The Fed looks at the CPI. And I mean, the OER is a huge tailwind for inflation. And so you're saying that headline, even with this OER thing, CPI will be month over month negative.
Well, you're going to be looking at it and you're going to be saying to yourself, everything that you count and you see in your life in terms of a current price is falling like a rock. Okay? Now, the Fed might say, look, CPI is still going up because we have strange things happen statistically. But the Fed's going to be facing what everybody calls deflation now. And they're going to be talking about it. They're going to make the adjustments themselves because the market is good at figuring out what the adjustment should actually be. They're going to be talking deflation. And that's 2023's theme, is deflation. We're going to have, the Fed is pushing the world into a severe recession. You know, you got all these guys meeting in D.C. right now. They're all furious at the U.S. for the interest rate policy it's pursuing. If you think about our interest rate policy and what I told you about the story of the bullwhip effect, you wouldn't raise rates.
Richard, why? If you worked with Volcker, if hiking interest rates doesn't do anything to combat inflation, does hiking interest rates do anything to slow the economy? And also, why why was 5% in 2007 not too high in 2007 before like a huge great financial crisis, but now 3% is too high in 2021 when inflation's at 2022 when inflation's at 8.5%.
I think of the economy as the one of the biggest drivers in the economy is housing. I think that's what 15% of the economy. Housing in the U.S. has always been sold, or at least since the Great Depression, it's been sold on what's the maximum payment you can afford on a monthly basis. Okay, that's the house you should buy. Okay, that's how people buy their house. Well, when we took long-term mortgage, you know, the 30-year mortgage, down to 3% or less, the market adjusted down to 3% or less. Okay? When you raise rates from 3% to 7% like they just did, you suddenly are looking at house prices in order to keep the same payment if you were a prospective buyer as the current owner has. House prices have to decline on the nature of 35%. Okay? So how many people have bought a house for, say, $400,000 that they're going to be willing to sell for $260,000?
Yeah. No, the mortgage market is already in like a nuclear winter in terms of, you know, if you have a mortgage business, I mean, originations, refinancings are down 60%, something like that. So it's not a good time to have a mortgage origination business. What you said is right. I mean, I heard 30%, but yeah, 35% sure. But that does not mean that the house prices will go down by 30% or 35%. I mean, we'll see.
I always like to tell people during the peak pricing in 1980-81, people still took mortgages. When you need to get a house, you need to buy a house.
Yeah.
Okay. People will still be buying some houses, but where the houses will meet what people will be able to afford, that's going to be a far lower number. You're going to see far fewer transactions if you're a builder. Okay? Chances are you've already purchased the land that you were going to put the house up on. That house that you were going to put on that piece of property is no longer something you can sell at a profit because of what the Fed did and the speed with which they did it. So builders are just going to sit on land rather than take losses. So we're going to have aggravated the housing shortage. People who have a low-rate mortgage, they're already saying that they're not going to move because you'd have to get a huge bump in salary to justify moving across the country, you know, for a new job. And think of the loss you're going to take on your house when you come to sell your house. So we've got people now locked into a position where they can't get out of their house. I mean, we have really dramatically changed the economy here in a very negative way. Okay, but house prices are going to continue to fall. People are going to watch as the house prices in their neighborhoods slowly decay. Things that are going to happen. People are going to save more money. Demand's going to go down. As we have been slaughtering the stock and the bond market. Think of who owns most of the stock and the bonds. It's the baby boomers, right? They're in retirement age. Many of them already retired. The way people operate in retirement is, you tell me how much money I can spend without running out of money before I die, and that's what I'm going to spend. They're all
good. That's the boomers. They're spending too much money. They were too rich. The boomers need to be cut down a peg. That's why we need to do QT to decrease asset values. Good.
You're cutting down a peg.
I'm with Jay. I should wear a button that says I'm with Jay. You're not with Jay though.
The reason I'm not with Jay is because your generation needs buyers. Okay, it needs demand. It needs people to be consuming. When the boomers
cut too much demand, though. I mean, inflation's at 8%. There's too much demand.
It's not demand driven. The inflation's on the supply side. Our supply hasn't caught up to the demand. Okay, They're still asking for things that the supply side can't generate. I mean, one of the reasons we had the problem is, look at China for a second here. See, you guys can blame, by the way, the boomers for this. Over the last 40 years, the boomers moved manufacturing out of the U.S. over to China. Now what we have is China doesn't open up the supply chain back to the U.S., so we don't have products that people want. Okay, and we can't manufacture them. So now they're talking about maybe we should move manufacturing back towards the U.S., move it to Latin America or someplace like that. But the point is, we have a supply problem, supply chain problem. And this is what I've been saying, that's the driver of inflation. The San Francisco Fed had an interesting study, an interesting chart, where they had 8% inflation that they show. They show 2% of it is demand driven. They got 4% of it being ambiguous, is the author's term, and the rest of it being supply driven. And when you go into what's ambiguous, you see most of that's supply related. We're really in a position where this is a supply problem. That bullwhip effect perfectly describes what we're seeing.
Why do you think the economy can't handle 3% rates?
Oh, I think the economy could handle 3% rates, okay? There's a difference between handling a 3% rate and handling 7, 8% on a mortgage rate when we've been at 3%.
I'm talking about Fed funds. So yeah, the Federal Reserve does not control the mortgage rate, but they do control Fed funds. Fed funds went from 0 to 3. Mortgages went from 3 to 7. Yeah.
I think it's overkill having mortgages go from, you know, 3 to 7. I think you want mortgage rates down in the 4.5. They want to go from 3 to 4.5. You want a more active housing market. You just don't want to kill the housing market and the development market. That doesn't, to me, make any sense. Okay?
I mean, it was too strong. I mean, if house prices were going up 20% a year and you could get a mortgage at 3%, so you pretty good returns. I mean, so if houses are going 20% a year, you're getting 3%, you could finance it with 3% debt, then I'm going to buy a house. And then the bubble continues. So you need, you know? It was too hot. It was too hot, Richard.
You might say it was too hot, but I'm going to come back and go, this was a market that was already on its way down. Because remember, people were still dealing with COVID. So you have a lot of people who are in the baby boom generation who own a house who aren't in the right size house for what they want going forward.
So why did the house prices go up 20% year over year?
Because the people who were in this baby boom generation who have this house, they weren't selling as long as we had COVID and we had this notion that you had to be shut down. So they were being very conservative in what they were doing.
Richard, there was a lot of demand, and this is non-monetary, but there was a ton of demand of people moving just because of COVID. Yeah.
We had a lot of shifting around of that because of COVID. I agree with you. But again, if you think of kind of the changing of the demographics a little bit there, what you see is that's all eased back. Okay? Companies are now saying, well, not so fast going off to Boise. Mm-hmm. When you work in San Francisco, you need to be in here at least one day a week. Okay? So the Boise market, you can see, has taken a dramatic downturn. And that has to do with, as I said, a knowable pendulum swing back. You could have seen that coming. Markets like Phoenix, you know, are going to weaken because Phoenix is attractive to old people. Old people die. Their children seldom want their Phoenix place. So it goes on the market. So there tends to be a steady supply that comes on. Okay? Now, the other thing we had going on in some of these markets is that we had Wall Street buying houses. Okay? Those deals at 3% worked at 5% mortgage rates. They're done. And in fact, Wall Street's now in the position of where they're trying to get rid of all those houses that they now own.
I think that if we haven't already reached it, the probability is that we've already, you know, we're very close to peak inflation. Of course, energy could go back, you know, oil could go back up to $150, which is another tail risk that the Fed has to control, and that's why the Fed can't, you know, cut. I mean, Arthur Burns, the guy who's famous for being way too loose, he raised interest rates to what, 9% when with the, there was a OPEC shock in 1974?
My thing here is that the concern about being Arthur Burns is because you're not focused on the right narrative. If you focused on the narrative that really has dominated and describes what's happened to the economy, which is the supply, the bullwhip effect, and now you're looking at the supply chains, you can go, what can the Fed reasonably be expected to do with inflation versus what can't it do? The idea of raising rates, according to Powell, was to also drop the number of job opportunities and to increase unemployment.
Yeah, he did say that, but yeah, it's yes.
Okay.
It's the implication, yeah.
That's a horrible policy. I do not know one person who is able to deal with inflation better when they are unemployed. Okay? Better to face 10% a year inflation with a job than without a job.
Richard, I mean, this is going to sound cold-hearted, but like, I'm not saying I believe it, but this is the analysis that's the point. They won't deal with inflation, so they'll spend less money, so there's less demand. So the prices of things will go down.
We haven't shown that less demand, as I said, in the early 80s, we couldn't show that reduction in demand reduced inflation. This is the thing about the Fed narrative about monetary policy.
So it just happened. So if you put up a chart of, Fed funds rate and consumer price index, it just so happened. So to the extent that the Fed funds rate follows inflation, we all know that makes sense because people do believe in this theory and that when inflation goes up, Fed governors hike interest rates. But to the extent that high interest rates are frequently accompanied with inflation shooting down, you think that's just a coincidence?
Like
in 1970 when interest rates shot up, oh, inflation peaked and we had a recession. 1974, interest rates shot up, we had a recession, inflation went down. 1980, interest rates shot up because inflation was up, then inflation went down and we had another recession. It seems like it's a lot of things that just happened to... It seems like a lot of coincidences to me, Richard.
I'm going to stay with you here on Jack. You got to stay with me on energy. You got to keep looking what happened to the energy side. The problem we had in 81 at the Fed was we could do this analysis, but we couldn't show, once we accounted for energy and its impact, that monetary policy worked. This was
but
a big
monetary
problem.
Policy doesn't work. Why does it matter that they've hiked from 0 to 3%? You know, I mean, by saying, oh, mortgage rates are too high because they went from 3% to 7%, and by the way, the reason that is because Fed funds rate went from 0 to 3%, and that's causing this massive deflation with housing. Aren't you saying that monetary policy does work? Like, if monetary policy doesn't work, Fed funds at 100%, right?
Wait a second. But how has it worked? What has it done? I've noticed it's gone to 7% on the mortgages. And how's inflation doing, Jack? Inflation is percolating right along, and you're telling me that there's some tailwind.
But the housing market has slowed, and the housing market has slowed so much that you're worried it will cause deflation. I mean, I think it's worked okay in the housing market.
Wait a second. I'm going to you. The housing market is going to give us a big contraction in our economy. Okay? We're going to get deflation, which is measured as price changes, because the inventories that we have are going to go down decidedly in terms of people wanting to liquidate. Prices are going to drop. So all that's going to flow through. We're looking at a deflationary situation.
This deflationary situation that you see in the future, the culprit behind that is a very weak housing market. And the culprit of the weak housing market...
No, that's not the only thing I'm saying to you. We got all this other stuff in terms of supply. I mean, the way of looking at this is, take the chart that was...
Sorry, Rich. I'm sorry to interrupt. But it just seems that based on how I perceived your analysis earlier, you do think monetary policy works to some degree because you thought that raising rates slowed the housing market. Do you think that or do you not think that?
Oh, I definitely think that you can slow a housing market with it. But that doesn't necessarily slow inflation the way you're thinking it slows inflation. Okay? That's the point I'm trying to get at. I mean, if you think
but it will. I mean, if CPI is housing prices, the Case-Shiller, is correlated to rent and owner overfluent rent. Very correlated. Okay. With a lag. You know, I was talking to very, you know, professional economists in the summer of 2021. I'm like, hey, these house prices are going crazy. Like, you know, call me Mr. Simpleton, but like, if house prices go up 30%, shouldn't rent go up 30%? I was told, oh no, they're different markets, but they're not different markets, Richard. They're not. It will take a year.
Okay, now let's try something for you, Jack.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what you want to do is lower inflation, right? That's the goal. So what we do is we crush demand. I take 50% of the demand out of the system. Okay? My thesis is, as soon as you start adding back any of that 50% demand that you took out, what was causing inflation before returns. So you're going to get inflation back. You didn't do anything to inflation.
But housing was a cause of inflation.
What?
That's why OER is so high and why rent is so high, is because the housing market was so hot, right? I mean,
right? But now we're going to have a very slow housing market. It's going to be accompanied by unemployment. It's going to be accompanied by all sorts of stuff. But one of the things it's accompanied by is nobody's going to be building units. Very few are going to get built. So now, let's imagine that somebody comes along and says, it's time to get the economy going again. So Fed, we're going to cut rates. Because you're saying that should have an impact on housing. We both agree. So now people are going to come out to buy houses. So what's going to happen to housing prices? They're going to go up, aren't they? They're going to go
up dramatically. Right, in the next cycle. Yeah, I'm talking about this cycle. Like, in four or five years, you're right, but I'm talking about...
You can't with inflation. You cannot... Inflation isn't something you go, oh, there's a next cycle. Okay? They've embedded it. It's the supply side. Unless you deal with the supply side issues, it comes back. To say that I spread it out over a decade doesn't mean I got rid of it. But in the meantime, what I did for that decade was pursued a whole series of bad policies.
Okay. I think that the argument that when interest rates are really low, everyone produces a lot of stuff and growth is very high because, you know, oh my God, I'm going to borrow at 50 basis points and I'm going to build a million houses. And therefore, inflation will be low because there are a million houses. But the problem is, when interest rates are at 50 basis points, you also spill demand. So I agree, you're right. But I mean,
go back to the 90s. Okay, we had house, you know, mortgages were at 8.5%, 9%. We sold a lot of houses at 8.5%, 9%, Jack. Okay, we built a lot of houses.
Yeah.
Okay, what I said earlier is the housing market adjusts based on monthly payment. Okay? It adjusted down to 3% because that's where the Fed took rates to. You're saying, ooh, it was ultra hot. The reason for it being ultra hot had nothing to do with something reproducible. Okay? It was a one-time blip that central banks need to look through. A pandemic is a one-time blip.
So you don't think that the Fed buying mortgage-backed securities and interest rates being at zero fueled it? You think it was purely supply, not purely, but...
If you look at the time leading up to it, the decade plus leading up to it, how come house prices didn't go much higher?
Yeah, no. That's a good point.
Under your assessment, if you go to Japan and do the same analysis, their mortgage rates are dramatically less. How come their house prices haven't had this gigantic run-up? This was a one-time, one-off occurrence. The pandemic was going to end.
You do grant that low mortgage rates create a lot of demand and high mortgage rates reduce demand, because you went so far to say that you can't raise mortgage rates because raising mortgage rates will cause inflation because it will cause people not to build in the next cycle. The next cycle thing. I don't know.
The argument here is that we're coming down through is the market adjusts to whatever level the mortgage rates are at. If you raise mortgage rates, you can shift the demand in any period. You can shift it forward or back. Okay, so I'm willing to concede that the Fed can do that with its ability to raise and lower rates.
Yeah.
Okay, if you shift...
Sorry to be a pedant, but the Fed raises and lowers overnight, like Fed funds rates, and then the mortgage rate adjusts. So the Fed does not control the mortgage rate, but in effect, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Okay, but you got to ask what QE does if, okay, when they're, quote, buying all those mortgage-backed securities, if you don't think that had an impact.
Oh, no, it definitely did. No, yeah. QE causes the spread between mortgage-backed securities and treasuries to compress, and QT causes them to widen. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So that effectively accelerates demand. Mm-hmm. But now you're saying, wait a second, we had this moment of the COVID where everybody is buying a house and running out of apartments. Okay? Which is what happened. Okay? And they could work from home. So suddenly there's this booming demand. But as we said, all of that's now reversing because the people in San Francisco say to the guys living in Idaho, you got to be in here once a week. And suddenly those people are going, oh, I got to get back up there. Okay? Suddenly that house in Idaho, oh, that's my second home. I need that condo back in San Francisco. Okay? Or the city. This is what we're dealing with here. What I'm suggesting here is the Fed has also decided, okay, what we want to do is kill that bullwhip effect. They're stepping into the middle of the effect. Prices were coming down on their own. And they're going to accelerate the decline. Okay? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what people are going to think when they realize that their house is worth 30% less? Okay? That's part of how people think of their net worth, wealth. That was where they were saving money. He's dramatically decreasing demand in this country.
By the way, I will bet you... I'll bet you 10 to 1. I mean, a gentleman's bet, but I'll bet 10 times more honor than you'll give me. So I'm very short convexity that the Case-Shiller will not go down by 30%. I agree that if someone had to sell their house, there might be conditions under which they might suffer a 30% loss, but they would not do it. The house. So if liquidity were infinite, those losses might happen, but the people just aren't going to sell their house. So sure. I think we maybe agree.
They're not going to sell, which means that the housing market is going to slow down to a real crawl. Not going to be any sales because the seller isn't going to be willing to take what the buyer would be able to offer.
It's not a good time to be a real estate agent, not a good time to be a mortgage originator. Very bad.
That market is getting crushed. There isn't going to be new product coming onto the market, you know, the new houses.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's all dying.
I mean, hey Richard, because we've been going this for 80 minutes and I want to ask you another topic. Let's just move on. Let's agree to disagree. But tell me why you think, maybe you said this to me months ago, that JP Morgan was insolvent or that other banks are insolvent. What did you mean by that?
Did you hear Jamie Dimon today saying how much money his firm was going to make in a recession?
I did.
Jamie bet against the industry in 2008. Now, as I told you, it's a great bet if and only if the counterparty can pay up. If the counterparties can't pay, you're stuck with the losses.
So where are the losses? Where are the losses? Because in 2008, we know the losses in 2008. Where are the losses now? Because JP Morgan is saying the credit losses that they're realizing are very small. Defaults are very small, are very low.
Let me step back a second. We've been in regulatory forbearance mode since 2008. Regulatory forbearance simply means if you are a bank and your client doesn't manage to make its interest payment, you can advance them under the terms of the loan the interest payment. So you claim they made it, and that is still a performing loan. Go back to the number of debt zombies I said to you. We're almost at 20% of corporate America is a debt zombie. There's no reason to think that its commercial lending business doesn't have a lot of bad debt in it, okay? We come to the consumers who the Fed is doing its bit to create unemployment. Who has the credit cards? where they're actually paying interest on their credit cards. That's the poorer people, right? That's not the sort of thing that somebody worth $10 million pays 18% on their credit card. Okay? So what you're going to see is the losses there are going to go up fairly dramatically. You can kind of go through his book of business. He's got a lot of places that are going to lose a lot of money. Bankers have always overlent. That's kind of in their nature, is to overlend. So he's counting on, as I said, his, where he shorted the market, covering his losses. That's the assumption he's making. And that means the counterparty's got to be good. And I'm not convinced these counterparties are good. I think we're still back to 2008. We didn't take care of the bad debt. We know there's a truckload of bad debt sitting out there. As I said, that's the debt zombies. Somebody's holding on to it. We got house prices going up. That's going to create more problems. I mean, by the way, I think we have a bad look at China. They blew up their property bubble. Mm-hmm. It turns out basically none of their developers are solvent. Okay? I think our developers are a little bit smarter, and we didn't quite let them have as much leverage, but I'm betting there's a lot of losses coming in the real estate. We also got losses on the commercial real estate side because, you know, work from home does reduce office demand.
Yes.
Companies kind of figured out, oh, wait a second, now I don't have to give Jack a office. I can have Jack share his office space with three other people. Okay, so we're going to have a lot of that type of adjustment too. I think over 30 years, the real estate industry can adjust, but I think there are going to be some huge losses between now and then. That's all I'm saying here.
Okay. So if I have J.P. Morgan's balance sheet in front of me, and we're not talking about securities,
okay,
bonds, mortgage-backed securities, whatever. We're talking about just loans, good old-fashioned like 1920s style loans. So there's consumer loans, business banking loans, which is commercial loans, home lending, credit card, and then auto loans. So you're thinking all four of those are ripe for...
Oh, yeah. Auto loans. Look at used car values.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For several months there, they were flying higher. And all of a sudden, used car values are plummeting like a rock. And I heard someplace where apparently the average monthly payment now that people have on their car loan is like $1,000 a month for a car loan. There's like no chance there aren't huge losses coming because they repossessed the car, you know? And it's a car that's not as valuable as what they've got up against it as a loan. So every one of those sectors. What you're also not factoring in is what do you think their exposures are off balance sheet, which is really the place where the lion's share of the losses are, to all the other banks.
What kind of off balance sheet debt, off balance sheet swaps,
derivatives?
Yeah. I mean, no, that is something I'm worried about. I mean, particularly like an institution like Goldman Sachs, which we're recording this on Friday, October 14th. I think it reports earnings on Tuesday, the 18th. But like, if you just look at the investment banking business, it's really in a very bad way. I'd say as bad as mortgages, I would say. Over 50% declines from last year. Of course, base effects last year was ridiculously high, unnaturally high. But like, I think the Morgan Stanley investment banking business this quarter for third quarter was lower than last year's, the year before it, the year before it, the year before that, the year before that. I think 2016 was the time you'd find a lower number just for pure investment banking business. So yeah, I mean, I just think that the business is really bad, and you know, I think that very very relates to QT. Which I think is a good thing. So yeah, just to the JP Morgan's total assets is like $3.7 trillion and its total deposits is $2.4 trillion. Basically, the total amount of loans that it has, it's not that much bigger than the equity it has.
I understand what you're saying there. Just go to, let's stay with JP Morgan because I love him. Okay, I mean, sure. I actually think Diamond is the best operator in the bank sector.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go to its derivative book because that's the one that nobody can see what the real risks are. I'm telling you, if you think back to, 2012 with the London whale, where supposedly he was hedging, and they managed to lose $12.5 billion on the hedges. Okay? We don't know, and even Jamie Dimon didn't know at the time, what exposures were being taken in all of these derivatives. There's no reason to think that these derivatives, as I said, a derivative is only as good as the counterparty on the other side.
I agree. But what about this particular macro environment makes it, you think that those derivative exposures will be bad? I mean, yeah, I'm really worried about the interest rate. So there's credit derivatives, equity derivatives, currency derivatives, and then interest rate derivatives. It is that latter one that I really think you could see some. That's what the pension crisis in the UK is all about, interest rate derivatives.
Well, it's about interest rate derivatives, but Goldman just came out and said, oh, by the way, Credit Suisse needs $7 billion worth of equity in their estimation. A not insignificant number. Mm-hmm. That tells you something about what Goldman is thinking is going on off its balance sheet. Because Credit Suisse is saying, oh, look at our pristine balance sheet. I mean, none of these banks are sitting on big losses on their balance sheet so far today. Mm-hmm. Okay? All I'm telling you is, every one of those banks knows what the realities of its own balance sheet. Okay? And they know the reality of their own balance sheet is not what's there for public consumption. And they're hoping, in Jamie Dimon's case, that he's got enough shorts on against all of his competitors when this blows up again, that he's going to remain standing. That's his bet. Because this is all going to blow up. You know, we got this highly leveraged system, and we're raising rates into a highly leveraged system. That is undoubtedly going to cause problems. You got inflation. I mean, I can't imagine exposures in Europe are worth much. I mean, look what's happening to Germany's economy. Mm-hmm. You got people like BASF, who I believe is the largest chemical company in the world. And basically, it is, because of not having access to natural gas, being effectively closed down a substantial portion of its business. So some of debt that you never would have thought might be not repaid is suddenly subject to losses. And that's a BASF, okay? There's a lot of stuff going on here with this energy crisis and higher interest rates, you know?
The common narrative, which up until this point has proven correct, sounds like you think it won't. The common narrative is that after the great financial crisis, regulation was passed to prevent toxic assets being built up on a bank's balance sheet or off a bank's balance sheet. So as you can't, for example, have a money market fund in France that owns asset-backed commercial paper that's backed by subprime mortgages that have, you know, 90 plus days delinquent. You can't have a CDO product, you know, that being traded just because it's AAA. It's a balance sheet capacity, you could have a lot more of it. You don't have to hold as much equity against it because it's AAA, even though it shouldn't be AAA. And that, you know, the bankers essentially, at least in the U.S., you know, MiFID, Basel III, have handcuffs on that prevent the sort of systemic risks to be built up. It sounds like you think that is a load of tosh. Tell us why.
It is more than a load of tosh. Truckloads. Trainloads. Yeah. Remember, I come from the world of looking at the world and asking the question of transparency. Is there enough disclosure so an investor could know what they own? And we actually have more securities outstanding today. That the answer when you ask that about the security, could you know, is no, then yes. It's actually more opaque, the global financial system today, than it was in 2008.
What's an example of a security that's more opaque than a synthetic CDO of subprime mortgages? I mean, they're literally, there aren't enough trees on earth to print out the paperwork of the different counterparties and stuff. Like, what's more complicated than that right now?
There's complicated. I said that they were opaque.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Where I draw a distinction is between those two. Complication, by the way, on Wall Street is always to create opacity.
Sure. So what's more opaque than a synthetic CDO, for example?
Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan's? Either one. Take your choice.
Well, which assets, though? Which assets?
Anything issued by them. Their equity. Their bonds. You have no idea what risks they are taking. None.
I'm talking about the complex stuff, like... What's being hidden, Richard?
When it complexity, there's nobody with a more complicated balance sheet than JP Morgan. Okay? There is nobody more opaque than JP Morgan.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah, I mean, having gone through their financials of them and from Goldman today in some detail, I do see what you're saying, yeah.
Okay. As investors, you do not know what their risks are.
But it was more opaque in 2007. That's what I'm saying. You think no?
No, listen. There has been no additions to disclosure that have made them more transparent. And transparency is one of these interesting issues in that either you are or you aren't. It's a 0-1. Either the data is available, the disclosures are available, or they're not.
Well, you could disclose 90% of it.
So the 10% that you don't, you still don't know what you own, right? You still don't know what the risks are hiding in that 10%. And by the way, for different entities, what you have to disclose so an investor could know, differ. If you are a bank, what you have to disclose is their current exposures. That's both on and off balance sheet. The market is actually incredibly good at assessing the risk of those exposures. Now, consider what that would do to Goldman's derivative portfolio if they suddenly realized that everybody was looking at their derivatives portfolio. They would shrink it significantly. Now, I've had some people argue with me that says, you know, if you disclosed everything that JP Morgan has as an exposure, nobody could understand it. Let me say, that might be true. And if it's true, that tells us that JP Morgan is too big to exist. Because if the analysts from B of A and Citi and Goldman can't understand it, that tells you that federal regulators can't understand it either. And it needs to be shrunk. This isn't a bug in transparency, it's a feature. And it gets these guys down to a size where they should be.
I think the analysts could understand it. I think the regulators could. Because here's the thing. It may be opaque about, let's say we have, you know, $40 billion worth of interest rate pay. We have like receiver swaption, so we lose money if interest rates go up. Like, I understand what that is. It's not disclosed, but I do understand what it is. Like, I feel like it's only a handful of asset classes, and it's not as complicated as like synthetic CDOs and reference securities and implied correlation of defaults of different tranches.
Let me say, you are right. It should be accessible and easy enough for the market to actually go, here's what you got. So as to actually say, here's the risk. We understand what risk you're taking at each of these entities. The fact that the risk is hidden is the problem.
Did you disclose derivative assets and liabilities? I mean, the valuation of those assets and liabilities is obviously depends on a lot of key assumptions, which there's a lot of opacity, you're right. Their value at risk models, that's interesting to look at.
Value at risk is an interesting concept that has never shown, that's great for regulators. As a market participant, I wouldn't recommend it. Okay. I helped to invent value at risk. JP Morgan had a group, a risk group, who actually should be credited with inventing value at risk. But they needed a first client. Thank you very much. My bank was either client one or two, but we pushed whoever you could call one to be then their first client. Okay. It's elegant in its way and simply shouldn't be relied on. Okay. But for regulators, it was fantastic because it got us to be able to get all sorts of favorable regulations through and suggested that we knew what our risk was and we were managing it better.
Like Basel II. Yeah, I mean, I do see a similarity, which is quite stunning, between something like mortgages, which historically was not volatile, or default rates, you know, not volatile, so you can lever it up huge, and treasury bonds or, quote, risk-free sovereign bonds that have tons of interest rate risk, but they don't move that much, so it's VAR, yeah. But, you know, treasury bonds are more liquid, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know, man. It's interesting. We got to close this. We've been doing this for close to 2 hours. Richard.
It's so much fun, Jack, because I'm going to leave you with one last piece just because it's so much fun. They say that treasury bonds are risk-free, except for a little interest rate risk. Yeah. Look what has happened to people who owned long-term bonds over the last year. Right. Those bonds got crunched by 26%. Okay.
More. Richard, more. 40% for zero coupon. I mean, TLT, something like 35. Yeah.
If you go to JP Morgan's balance sheet or you go to Goldman's balance sheet, those aren't marked to market. They're sitting in their investment portfolio. So banks don't actually have to recognize their losses. This is what I'm telling you. This is what the reason all has to be disclosed is. So you actually know whether they're solvent or insolvent, because solvency isn't a measure of is the book value of your assets greater than the book value of your liabilities.
Richard, great to talk to you. People can find you. I'm trying to read your Twitter handle. What is it? TYILLC?
Yep.
What does that stand for? Transparency?
No, it's actually trust your instincts.
Ah, okay. I like that. Okay, so people follow that. You're the author of Transparency Games, How Bankers Rig the World of Finance. People should check that out. And Director, Institute for Financial Transparency. Richard, total pleasure. I think this is the longest interview I've ever done.
Thank you, Jack. Have a great weekend.
There is something that you need to be doing right now, and that is reading the Blockworks Daily newsletter. For top market insights and the latest in crypto news, you have to subscribe to the Blockworks Daily newsletter, and you can do so by clicking on the link in the description to this video or by visiting blockworks.co/newsletter.